First thing is, if you're interested in the code, you probably want to take the URL, which is not on the CD. Otherwise, just come grab me. I'll give you the URL later. And I guess we should go. So first, doing a public service here. You have extra ice cream tickets. You don't know what to do with them. You still have about half an hour to run, well, after the talk, and give them all to Russell, who wants all your ice cream. He's right there, second row. There you go. He will be your friend forever. You're doing a good thing for open source here. That said, let's go with the actual talk. So the whole problem is keeping a lot of machines in sync, whether they're workstations, servers, you name it. In this case, I had to do it with Debian first and Red Hat and a couple of companies. And this is after having seen the disaster that was in some places I worked at, as in complete lack of install, nothing. So that's kind of a list of what you may have seen before, what you don't want. I think the worst and the most common, unfortunately, is random installs from random CDs that might not even be the same distribution. Or if you're lucky, it's the same distribution, but it's not the same release, like Red Hat 7 versus Red Hat 9, not the same libc. It's just really a pain to have to work with that and keep them in sync. Now, if you're a little bit luckier, you might have the same distribution everywhere. But each system may have modified the machine in different ways, changed the vMRC, changed God knows what. So the machines don't actually behave in the same way, and you keep saying, oh, this has to be fixed there, I forgot about it. And you keep doing the same things by hand. It's just not a good use of your time. Then, of course, you hit problems like, well, you have 300 workstations, and, well, SSH has a small problem, so you might have to upgrade it at some point. Or a case that I've had to work with. I like the penguin. Okay. And you have to upgrade SSH, or in my case, I saw LDAP being installed in AutoFS on all the machines. Now, the problem number one was, where are the machines? How many do we have? And what I saw, which made me really cringe, was a ping to broadcast to see all the IPs, and try to SSH to them, and if it worked, have a script to upgrade the software. This is not exactly the way you want to do things if you can avoid it. Of course, if you may have heard the last one, install server? What install server? That's the time where you back away, turn around, run. Or if really it's cold outside, it's warm inside, they have food, and you don't want to look for a new job, then you have to do something about it. So those would be the next slides. So what do you really have to do? You have to maintain workstations where sometimes the users actually are engineers and they like to have root and do random things in the machines. It's kind of pointless to keep root away from engineers because they'll get it anyway. I mean, they have console, right? So it's better to just assume they have it, even give it to them, give them sudo, and deal with it, which is what we're going to be doing. But engineers get creative. You guys know, come on. If you work in a company, you do strange things with the machines, and I'm sure some of the sysadmins have had a little chat with you for various reasons before. So you have to deal with that. Then you also have to work with servers and workstations if you're lucky enough to have Linux workstations in your company. And there's no reason to duplicate the work. For most things, it's actually the same amount of work, so you might as well do it for all of them at once. Now, of course, it's a little bit harder for servers because you don't have two servers that are alike. You might have five web servers or whatever, but then you have mail servers, calendar server, whatever. So those require different packages, and you have, your system has to deal with that. And you have to update software, which might seem easy, not always. Update configuration files. But I think the biggest problem by far is, let's say you have a way to push updates, and you actually keep all your machines up to date that way. You have to deal with the new machines that get installed from the install server. And in most places, what I've seen is there's a time window in between the time where you push the update, you fix the install server to have your update, which might be written in a different way, so you have to make sure both work. And then you have a time window in between where the machines got loaded and didn't get your push to the live machines, but didn't get the newly updated install. And they're in limbo in between, and now you have to find out about them in the hardware later. So very quickly, non-working solutions I've seen. The first one seemed interesting. All the workstations were actually rsynced every hour or nightly from the same image. It kind of solved the problem of having everything in sync with the install, regardless of what happened. But rsync doesn't get very happy when you're syncing 50,000 files or million files. It just takes forever, kills the machine, kills the install server. And then you have to take care of all the includes and excludes, because you can't just sync the same ifconfig data to all your machines. So you have a huge list of excludes, and you do really bad things like rsync the RPM database. Every single file is rsynced, right? Except user local, maybe. And that means you can't have a different package on the machine, because it just won't work that way. A slightly better solution that I've used in the past, just because it was easy to do, was a Shroot live image of a Debian install. All the machines got rsynced from that, so they were all running the same install. And when I pushed an update, it was an SSH push to all the machines, and the last machine was actually the install image, which happened to be running on the server I was typing the command. So everything was being updated at the same time in the same way. That was kind of a nice solution, except for the small problem that if you have servers or workstations that are down when you push, now you have to worry about those not having gotten the updates. And you have to remember, have a way to push it later. If you're doing replays, it has to be in the right order because there's dependencies. So it works well if you have 10 servers and your servers are up all the time, and if they're not, you're going to fix the server before you're going to push something. But otherwise, it's kind of a problem. Definitely does not work for workstations. Most of it's like you have a nice installed server with no updates, and then you kind of wing it. You don't really want to go there. And then you have the same thing with updates. So we just talked about that. That works fine, except for the time window between pushing updates and updating the install. And the fact that it may not be the same mechanism for both. So you have to duplicate the work and the paste. So what do you want? It should work, of course, for workstations and servers. You might have different classes of servers, like machines are really bare, stripped with just the bare minimum to boot. And the other ones that have all the stuff you might want, even God forbid Emacs or whatever. And then workstations, obviously. So you should be able, after that, to deal with machines that are down, which is quite common for workstations. So you should be able to keep them up to date and replay updates in order when they come back. If the update fails, you just retry it and until it works. Of course, if there's an error with the update, you catch the error, you fix the error, and then it replays, and it works at the end. If there's an error, it should not put the machine into an unknown state where you have to go fix it. The install should be updated at the same time than all the machines, so you don't have to do it twice. And especially, you keep it in sync at all times. And of course, you also won't be able to downgrade if something didn't work and roll back. That's kind of harder to do, actually. So on top of that, get updates give you a few more things. The initial install can be on any kind of media. You could also do something where you can load a live image on a hard drive, and we shift it to compact. They just made that as the install image all the machines we got. And when they came in, we didn't have to load them. The first time they boot the OS, they run get updates, and they get all the updates that were written since the disk image was shipped to the manufacturer. And that way, after a second reboot, they're completely up to date. Lead and gold. Funny things, everyone tells me, what is that lead thing? I don't understand what lead means. So the idea is, of course, you don't want to push everything to 1,000 machines and realize it's screwed up. So you have a small list of machines, mostly engineers and systems, and they run lead. And when lead works, you turn lead into gold. It's amazing. But most people get confused by that. So you can just use unstable and stable like Debian does. And of course, it's also nice to know how many workstations you have, because sometimes engineers load their own. So you get a list of machines. You know what packages they have, kernel, whatever, because they may upgrade the kernel themselves. So you can get a quick snapshot. So how do you do that? Well, let's not reinvent. Sorry. You can't hear me? I'm too far away? Better? Sorry. So let's not reinvent the wheel. Apt-get works fine. Works on Debian and Red Hat. So I just picked that. Then you use change sets, which are basically a shell script of what you want to do, and a compressed archive of all the files that you might want to push. And by files, I mean configuration files, things that you don't want to build an RPM or dev package just to ship. And it's the same program that's used when you load a machine from a boot CD or a floppy. When it comes up, it runs to get updates, and it gets the same change sets, so there's no doing two things two different ways. You see the variable target there, that's what says lead, gold, says whether it's a workstation or a server. That just gives you an example of the configuration file. Yeah, you won't see the cursor, so never mind. Just the NFS server you're loading from, or HTTP if you're using HTTP. A client info is where you actually store all the data for your machine every time you run. So you saw targets, lead versus gold, workstation versus server, and protocol. Right now I've done NFS and HTTP. It's not that hard to add a FTP or something else. So this is where you don't actually see anything, except you're on the first row with binoculars. So it works in the slides, but I'll bring a full-size version. Hopefully that is somewhat readable. So that's on the install server. You have the targets, each of them is a directory. You can have symlinks if you want. Test is just if you want to do something really strange and you don't want to even break the assessments, you can try that. For now, it's just a symlink in my case. Once you go inside one of the targets, you have all the change sets, which are each in a directory. There's a number in front of it that gives you a clue of which order they're going to be running in, because there's obviously a lot of dependencies between them. List at the bottom is actually what's retrieved by the client. So for NFS, it's easy to just do an ls, do an open dir to get the list of change sets. But for HTTP or FTP or whatever, it would be work to parse it. So you just grab the list instead. That way you don't have to worry about it. So I just give you, list is nothing fancy, it's just a list of change sets. If you go inside, you have work files, which is basically a tar of the files directory. And this is where you put your small shell scripts, configuration, whatever random files you want to ship. Update date is the magic tag, which is in Unix time, that tells you when is the last time you actually pull that update. Because you're checking every hour, you don't want to run the update every hour. You just get the date. If the date hasn't changed, you skip it. It's also used when you want to do debugging, where you can actually change the change sets on the local client that you're testing from. You can remove its tag of the last time it ran. So now it doesn't know about this update, and it will try it, which gives you a way to test a change set on your local machine without pushing it to everyone. The rest you can see the commands. Just a couple of random files. If you go in links is a fake change set. It's just the way to bootstrap get updates from the install CD or whatever. Instead of putting it on the CD and having something out of date, use the same mechanism to pull itself. So there's the funcs, which is a functions that are used both by get updates and by the change set themselves. We'll look at it later. The actual get updates program and a shell docking program, which comes from INN. So post-install, that's a more Red Hat thing, but Debian, depending on how you install it, you can do the same thing. The only thing you need to do is when you boot the installer, you can give options to the kernel, which is what Kickstart does on Red Hat. And that's what I use for get updates. I just pass it random variables. You cannot give too many because there's a command line length of 255. But you can pass a few things like NFS, HTTP, and tell it what an install server is. So that way you just change the Kickstart floppy, and you can point to different places. So this is more code that you can't read. I'll probably get back to it later. It's not extremely interesting to show right here. It's more if you want to read the slides at home. It shows you the bootstrap on Red Hat post install, which is basically how you get how you download get updates, how you start running it via both HTTP and NFS, and then how you record that on the local disk, so that if you do NFS the first time, it will remember to do NFS until you change it by hand. So for the implementation, you basically have shell variables that tell you where, if your workstation is a server, if you're lead and gold, so that you will use in your change sets if you need to do something specific for some classes of machines. And then you have a few functions that make your life easier. Install link. Well, for instance, let's say you want to replace a file like etc crontab. You want a different crontab for servers and workstations. So install link will actually move the crontab file out, rotate it out, and put the same link to whichever one you want. It's just a way to do it in one operation. But because changes will run several times, everything you write has to be designed to be rerun. So it checks if it's already a symlink, and if it's a symlink, it leaves it alone. It's nothing really fancy, but you don't want to have to rewrite it every time. Install file, we'll go back to it later. That's what's actually used to install a new file in the system or replace an existing one. So rotate. Then what's actually more interesting is the dpkg RPM wrapper or the apt-get wrapper. What was at the beginning was you don't actually know which state the machines are, even though you're controlling them, especially for workstations, engineers may have installed anything on it or removed packages or whatever. So you don't want to run apt-get install in a mode that it pulls all the dependencies and removes everything it's not happy with. Because if you get into a state that you're not expecting, bad things might happen. Also, an engineer may want to remove... I'll give you an example. With Red Hat 9, Nautilus just doesn't work well at all. So some people remove it so that they can just use GNOME without Nautilus. But if you install Galleon, it depends on Nautilus. So it reinstalls it, and then it gets pissed off. For good reasons. So that's how the apt-get wrapper, it runs in trivial mode, which says don't install anything that's not on the command line. There's also a minus option to remove something. So that way you say exactly what you expect to install and remove on the one command line. And if it's not that, it doesn't run, and then you have to fix it by hand. And if you really, really have to do it, there's a few cases. This apt-get force, which is the one you would have from the command line that removes and installs everything. It would be for cases like replacing the MTA, like in my case, apt-get install exim. You can't just remove sendmail because there's dependencies. You have to do it in one fell swoop. And that's where you use apt-get force. So, installing files. If you're installing a new file, it's not a big deal. You just install the file. The next time around, you can either reinstall it in the same place. In this case, it actually looks at the MD5 checksum. If the MD5 hasn't changed, it just leaves it alone. However, it gets more interesting if you're rotating a file that's already shaped with the system. And then you have to deal with the fact that the user may want to modify the file to do what they need. So this is done the following way. The first time you install the file, if there's already a file that has the same name, you rotate it out, you put yours, and you make it immutable, which means that even as root, you cannot modify that file. If the user then goes and tries to change it, even as root, they try to save it and they get permission denied. That's a clue without even reading the documentation that this file is maintained by the sysadmins. So it's a good way to give feedback right there that you should not be touching it, or you should be asking or see what you need to do. If the user actually needs to override this, what they do is they make the file mutable. So they use ch attribute minus I. The next time getupdate runs and tries to put a new version of that file, it sees the file is mutable, so it leaves it alone and put a small warning for the sysadmin to tell them, well, this machine has its own file, so maybe it's okay, maybe it's not, you just deal with it. Then there's a few other cases, basically, but those are the most common ones. You can also install a file and leave it writable for various reasons, and in this case, you have to track the MD5 checksum every time. So the interesting part is writing the change sets. The change sets were the directories I showed you, and they had a file called runme, which is a shell script. That's what gets pulled over to the client with the tar file. The tar file gets untarred, and the runme gets run. So because they get run more than once, typically, everything you write in there has to be designed to be run multiple times. So if you do something that should only be done once, you have to save state in a way so that you don't redo the same thing over and over again. The next rule is you do not generate any standard error outputs unless it's an actual error you're not expecting. So anything you know is going to put an error, you just catch it, you send it to dev null or do whatever you want with it. But the idea is this runs from cron, and you don't, it's actually the output gets redirected somewhere else, but you don't want 500 machines to send you, diff is equal or something, I forget what the exact output is, but something trivial that you don't need to see. And another common one is actually RPM. If you install RPMs, it tells you, I can't verify this signature because you don't have the key, or this package doesn't even have a signature. So the RPM wrapper actually removes them. If you're in a very secure environment and you're willing to rebuild all the RPMs that you get on the net and sign them yourself, then you can remove that warning. And you can also cause RPM to fail if the signature doesn't match. Same thing with the packet. The next thing was, one of the requirements I stated was you cannot get into an unknown state. So once any command fails, you stop. And you do not go beyond that until the error is fixed. It seems annoying, and it is annoying, but that's the only way to not have a shell script go halfway, fail something critical, and then do lots of stupid things afterwards that were depending on that command that failed, and just do bad things to your machine. So any command that might fail, but that's okay to fail, you say command or true, because that way you get a zero at the end and bash is happy. I'm actually using the bash error exit, which lets you set a trap and give an error message and then exit from the shell. We already looked at the apt-get install. You cannot just use apt-get and get all the dependencies. We looked at why. And the short version, really, the summary of all this is, you're not behind it when it runs. It runs on maybe 500 machines or more, especially with workstations. You should expect anything, even what you're not expecting. And usually you don't, and you find out that it's an error, but it's a good thing because it stops. You can see what the problem is, and then either modify the change set or just fix that one machine by hand, and then rerun the change set by hand. I found interesting things like an engineer, well, more than one actually, and I have nothing against engineers, don't take me wrong, I love them, they pay my salary. But thought it would be cute to repoint the apt source to a completely different place, like I think fresh RPMs instead of ours. So now all the apt-get commands would try to run completely different packages that would completely fail to install. And I find that actually either a 50-round Gatling gun with Nerf weaponry works fine, or a baseball bat if you don't have that. So I'll give you a couple of code examples of more stuff you can't read. So it's thinking about it. I think I need more RAM. Okay, so that's a change set that actually you use to modify the password on, is it the workstations or servers? It is on the workstations. So the password gets set by the installer, and that's actually a little comment here. You have to change it in the Kickstart installer too if you change it. But that's a way to sync a new password to all the machines. I also install Sash, which I find very useful to fix machines, especially servers when they're remote and they're not in a good state. You can almost always log in with Sash, but you have to keep both passwords in sync. Well, you don't have to, but at least we do. And a little kind of a pull trickery that to just get the password and change it in etc shadow, nothing really fancy, and add someone to sudoers. So if you look at the bottom of the screen, that's what I was talking about. You check for the entry you want to add, and if it's not there, you add it. That way, you don't just keep adding the same line over and over again. Right. Okay, so you look at this one on the slides. We'll pretend we can read it, probably in the first row even. I'm not sure. Basically, the sixth line says install file. That's just an example. It shows the directory you install in the file, and that automatically gets it from the tar, so you don't have to do anything fancy to get it there. And installs it on the system, checks the MD5 checksum, does all the rotation, everything you need in one command. The Then there's a few other examples of fixing Red Hat things to be like they should be, which is what Debian does, like putting all the configuration files in etc. So I fix all the Midnight Commander stuff to be in etc. It moves the file, my files over, does symlinks. And installing again will do it once, and then it won't do it again and fail. And I guess I'm not going to go further because you can't really read anything anyway. I'll give you the URL at the end so you can get the slides. So how do you actually push all this? So we're talking about that RenMe, which is a shell script. We actually keep it in P4 or CVS or whatever you want. You check the code that you're typing, obviously. Once it looks like it's running, you install it in the right directory. So in this case, workstation led, X will be the change set name, and RenMe is the shell script that gets pulled. So not only do you check on led, obviously, but then what you do is you do that little date trick where the workstation remembers what is the last time update it saw. You remove that flag. So now the next time it runs, which you trigger by hand, it will pull that change set, run the code as if it were really running. And once you're happy with that result, then you can type a make update, which will update the Unix time. And now all the machines in led, in this case, will go to get your update. Same thing with configuration files. You copy them in files. There's a make file that recreates the tar. That's not rocket science, really. And yeah, at the end, you change the bit date, which is what I was talking about. In theory, you do lead first and lead gold, and then gold, I'm sorry, or stable and stable. If you feel that your change cannot possibly break anything ever, then you could do both. Just don't screw up. So then I'm using an app tree. On Debian, it's no big deal. Everyone knows how to do that. On Red Hat, it's a little bit more convoluted. There's a little bit of documentation, but it's not extremely good. So I'll put a sample tree that you can use. And same thing then for change sets, and that's kind of a small problem. You have to both put the code of the new RenMe and everything else, and at the same time, if you're installing new RPMs or devs, you put them in the app tree. So you have to synchronize those two, otherwise you're running apt-get command on a package that's not there yet. Seems simple, but it's the kind of thing you sometimes forget about. And when you're happy with that, you can move all the RPMs from led to gold. What's also nice is providing extra RPMs that don't get installed by default for everyone. And for that, you can make an express directory. In theory, you can use pinning on apt to say, this tree is there, but don't use it unless the user forces it. I found out that it actually doesn't work with apt RPM. It seems to be a known bug, which is kind of unfortunate. So I have a problem, like Mozilla 1.5 doesn't work with Remedy. Stupid thing. And some people want 1.5. So if you put in the app tree, the next app get upgrade gets the new Mozilla, which you don't want. So that's really what you want that pinning in extra for. Hopefully AptRPM will be fixed for that. Client info, that's what I was talking about initially. So every time get a date runs, it goes in auto client info, which is OFS in our case, MAC address, and inside there it puts a lot of hardware info, the host name, multiple IPs, the get update run info. So when the get update runs, all the output goes to a log file, and there's a script that goes and walks all those machines' directories gets all the log errors and sends one summary email at the end of the hour. So you don't get 500 emails or whatever, you just get one. Although it might be a very long one if you made a mistake on all the machines. What you also find in there, the target, so you know how many machines are running light and cold. You can find how many people have installed a custom package by looking at the RPM QA or dpackage list output. You can find the owner. So if you have to move a lot of machines, you can find who owns what pretty easily. That's not really anything fancy, it's just using foo, but it works reasonably well for most cases. It's also nice to be able to sync, to link a hostname to a Mac or the other way around in one simple fashion. Pushing. So this is all a pull mechanism, right? It's designed to work even behind a firewall with just an HTTP proxy or behind NAT or whatever. So pushing is not really something you want to do for real work, because you might not be able to reach all the machines because of NAT, or some machines may be down, which usually they are if you have enough of them. But it could still be useful in some cases. If you really, really broke things, like if you push a new GET update that's broken and does not get new updates, well, that's at least one way to recover on most machines. It's using a root SSH key, obviously, nothing really fancy there. It could also be used to trigger an update run right now. Maybe something is very urgent, you don't want to wait for the next hour, so you can just go on all the machines and force them to run right away. Or you can get stats pretty quickly. Again, it's an incomplete list, but you know, it may just be what you need, so you can use it for that. And we use symlinks just to deal with configuration files that are not the same everywhere. That's not rocket science. I'm sure all of you do that. Syslog, runtab. For servers, it's usually very useful, especially if you have machines on a DMZ that can't talk to your LDAP server and things like that. And for that, you use install-link. It takes care of all this. So, this actually worked pretty well. I mean, we've gone a long way with it. It's been now used for 7 months or so, and it's not completely perfect, but we haven't had any real issues with it or anything we couldn't do with it. But you can always do better. For instance, rollbacks. If you do an apt-get install of a new package, rolling back is actually quite painful in some cases. Also, apt-rpm actually has a special hack to deal with packages that have the same name by putting the version number into the name. And that's in the configuration file somewhere. But reverting from that means you have to go on all the machines, change the configuration file, blow the cache, and rebuild. Things are a little bit painful. But if you just push, let's say, a new Mozilla and you have to revert, the only way to really do that is to force a delete and then reinstall it after removing it from the app tree. So if you just wanted to have some way to revert right away, you could use an LVM snapshot for that. It's not terribly efficient on Linux because it tends to cross double writes until you drop the snapshot. But if you only keep one in its workstations, that might just work well enough for you. For security, you could just add checksums to all the change sets, so you make sure you get what you're expecting, or even sign them if you have time. But of course, that's kind of pointless unless you also sign all your RPMs or debian packages. GET updates runs from cron, so if crond dies, well, no more updates. So a restart of a cron is probably a good thing. Client info is written over NFS, so you could write some code to bundle all that information and do an HTTP upload instead. In practice, it has not been useful for us yet, or at least not worth the effort. But I think the biggest thing really is have a way to have a fail-safe get updates if the main one dies. Because sometimes we add code to it, and if you really make a big mistake and now you actually break your update mechanism, well, you kind of lose. So having a small get update that just goes and is able to bootstrap itself again would be a very good thing. And there's multiple ways to do that. You can just have a way to have one that everyone gets, or you can use the last bytes of the IP or anything like that. There's also a security problem with that, obviously, so you have to be careful with that mechanism. The last one is, I really love apt-get, being a Debian user. On apt-rpm has a few shortcomings, and Fedora is going with Yum, which everyone tells me is a much better tool. So it might be something, if you're implementing your own, you might want to be using that instead. And if and when we switch to Fedora, we might also switch to Yum. Now I'm doing a favor to my boss, who's Australian, and he wants to have more Australians in the team. So if you're Australian, or if you're not, and you need a job, just send me a quick email. We'll be happy to have you over. And then we can learn proper Australian English instead of American. That would be a good thing. And then we have, oh my god, I'm actually on time. We have time for questions. Give me 1 second. Just to draw attention away. It has nothing to do what server would talk, so don't pay attention to it. Questions? Sorry, one more time. So, it's actually illegal to do that for RPMs. For Debian, you have debconf. And all packages should be using debconf now. If they don't install them, fix them, bug the author. But last time I was doing automated dpackage installs, debconf was pretty widespread. So you just see the database with the answers that you're expecting. Oh, so it's auto client info, it's an NFS server. So it's just sitting on a Right. So you can pull it from one place. And there's a shell script that runs every hour and pulls all the errors from there. I kind of look at how bad they are and how much work I have that day. Because really pushing one update or 10 is the same amount of work. But there's some kind of, there's a few things to do every time you push something. Half of it is procedure. So you don't, I try not to push something every day. So it's not hard, it's just a little bit of work. And also, if it's a bad update, if it's a bad problem, you might want to push to both lead and gold at the same time. So it really depends on the case. So those are just maintained by the system itself. There's a script that takes care of changing the machine's IP and hostname. Those are not maintained by Getabase at all. They're maintained locally. Sorry? Oh, no, not at all. Some config files are local to each machine, so there's no reason to have them different. To have them pushed, because, well, they're different everywhere, right? Yes. Right. Well, we've actually gotten, like, at some point we got 100 workstations to load. We just loaded them 10 at a time with a boot floppy or boot CD. But if you know in advance and you have someone who's willing to preload hard drives, that's what I was explaining. You make a hard drive image, you give it to them, and they will preload the hard drive for you. So when you get the machine in, you plug it in, of course using DHCP, so it comes up, pulls the next update, and that's it. So it's a normal floppy that installs a normal distro, except at the end, there's a post-install, and that's where you do your own step at the end. Right. So you do, for the distro install, you just put them there, and so that's nothing fancy. Then you have your own packages that you put in a different directory. I'm not sure I understand your question. Oh, okay, so it goes back to how do you shape configuration files. I think it's silly to build a new RPM or a new deb to ship an updated config file. Also, if you need to make local modifications on some machines, then updating the package rotates out or blows away the local file. So I just think it's way too much overhead to push a new config file, really. So I don't use that. That's why I use the other mechanism. But if you wanted to, you could definitely, I mean, some people don't actually use all this. All they do is navget update every night and build everything into scripts into the RPM or the deb. I don't think it's that flexible, and it's a lot more work, in my opinion. But it's doable, yes. Yes. Yes, I'll put it back. I'll put it back at the end, actually. Is there other people we need? Well, just wait a second at the end. I'll put the URL at the end. Anyone else? You don't, I'm sorry. Yeah, safe search is boring. I took it out of the code. That's it? Okay, thank you.